Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, welcome to India, Russia and the world. You've been dealing with New Delhi for over two decades now. This special and privileged strategic partnership, it's got all the right optics. It's got the summits, it's got the Modi-Putin handshakes and hugs, it's got buzzwords like oil and defense that recently have been making headlines. But what would you say, Foreign Minister, is the real, the actual substance of the India-Russia partnership today?
Well, it's not only oil and gas, it's much more. It started not 20, not 30 years ago, it started with Indian independence. From the very beginning, the Indian leaders visited the Soviet Union, the Soviet leaders visited India, and this established very strong, confidential, personal relationship. And personal relationship always helps in this life. This was accompanied by developing a solid material foundation for Russia, Soviet Russia, Indian partnership. The explanation of what this partnership means was evolving. It started like partnership, then it became strategic partnership, then it became privileged strategic partnership. And then under, Manmohan Singh, it became especially privileged strategic partnership. The fact that the economies of Russia and India are mutually complementary is also helping. The fact that from the very beginning, India was very interested in military technical cooperation played also a great role. Basically, no Western country, for a long time after India gained independence, no Western country wanted to help India to develop its military and Russia now, Russia is not only, we started like seller and buyer, but now we not only sell, we sell less and less, but we produce together. We started with BrahMos missiles, then Kalashnikov machine guns, and now it is also T-90 tanks being produced in India. And if you take a look at other areas of human life, we, in addition to Intergovernmental Commission on Economic and Trade Matters, and the plans are very, very far-reaching. In December last year, when President Putin visited Delhi, they adopted a plan on developing strategic components of economic cooperation, high-tech and the like, through the year 2030. And there is also a plan on military technical cooperation for the same period. Mm-hmm. It's a long-term, mid-term planning. In addition, movie festivals, we attend movie festivals which each of our countries conduct. We also have regular cultural events, Russian cultural weeks in India and the other way around. And of course, academician, political scientists meet regularly. So, education. Many Indians study in Russia and continue, after they graduate, they continue to work to promote this link, which is really one of the most important stabilizers in the region and in the world. I will shift to Russian after your next question.
The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, he talks about Viksit Bharat, that's developed India by 2047. How do you see Russia contribute to that vision? What role does Moscow play in the India of tomorrow?
Well, it's up.
First and foremost, it's for the Indians to decide what kind of vision they have for their country when they celebrate 100 years of independence. And naturally, Prime Minister Modi, one of the most vibrant leaders ever seen by the world, he has not just the vibrant energy, he focuses it on very important goals and achievements, achieving absolute sovereignty in all spheres, be that economy, military, defense, or culture. And naturally, maintaining the civilizational heritage that India has like no other. As for the Eurasian continent, I think it's unique in the fact that it's not only the largest and the richest continent, but it's also the continent of several great civilizations. Indian, Chinese, Persian, Ottoman, and Russian, of course. This continent, well, I'm taking a long path towards answering the question. This continent is to play a great role in the stabilization of the international situation. The Eurasian continent does not have one big structure over there. There is OSCE in Europe, there is ASEAN, there are other integrational frameworks in South Asia, including India. Naturally, there's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, post-Soviet cooperation associations, Eurasian Economic Union, the CIS, and CSTO as well. However, there is no single umbrella association. It doesn't need to be an organization, but some kind of form where all of Eurasia could talk to each other clearly. It is not yet in place. It can be largely explained by the fact that Europe still maintains its colonial and neo-colonial mentality. It wants to dictate its own habits and order. The EU and NATO are trying to expand their hands over all of Eurasian territory. They are starting already to say that NATO is concerned about what's happening in South Chinese Sea and in the Strait of Taiwan and Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia. I think that countries with ancient history, great civilizations, who have preserved each other until our time and that continue to develop, they should become cognizant of their own responsibility at some point. That this Eurasianness, to translate from colonial times and neo-colonial times into partnership, mutual understanding. Moving towards the stage of overcoming differences in status that some of our Western colleagues are still very attached to. Moving to the stage of inter-civilizational dialogue, mutual dialogue. I think that Russia, India, and China could play a special role in that area. But going back to your question, what India could reach by 2047. Primarily, it will depend on the Indian nation and the focus of the Indian leadership. And since Narendra Modi is so focused on that, in the early stages, when 2047 was not yet the goal, Prime Minister Modi introduced the concept of Make in India. I think that we, Russia, were possibly the first country who did not just consider and this concept in our practical steps in the sphere of cooperating with India. Way before that, we started producing BrahMos cruise missiles, before Make in India became the official motto and the practical demand for partners of India. India is growing exponentially. Its GDP is 7% per year. And certainly, India needs energy to a large degree. And we hear that your prime minister asked to save energy given the crisis that erupted in the Persian Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, after the U.S. and Israel's aggression against Iran. However, Russia has always lived up to its commitments before India and others in terms of energy supplies. And certainly, our flagship project today is the Kudankulam MPP, and it ensures it meets a significant part of energy needs of India. We continue to build new energy units of this nuclear power plant, and still India needs more. We continue to supply our hydrocarbons, gas, oil, and coal. And besides traditional energy, we are working on green energy with the Indians. And given the scale of the Indian growth, everything will come in handy. I believe that this is a smart policy to ensure such energy capabilities that would be credible for the years to come, for many years to come. Let me reiterate that Russia is a credible energy supplier. We value this reputation, and we have never violated our commitments. Certainly, I've mentioned military and technical cooperation. India's defense capabilities in the area of our cooperation, where we practically have no secrets from our Indian friends. I've mentioned when India became independent. For many years, the West did not want to interact with India on this track. When it started showing interest in weapons supplies to India, it always did it, taking into account its secrets. But we virtually have no secrets with our Indian colleagues.
When sanctions hit Rosneft and Lukoil, Indian oil imports from Russia, they dropped drastically. Was that a moment of concern in Moscow? And did that in any way change the way Moscow views New Delhi as a partner?
Well, India has nothing to do with that. We're talking about an illegitimate decision by the United States. And this was all made under the pretext of Ukraine. President Trump has repeatedly stated that Ukraine is Biden's war. It's not my war. Nevertheless, we value the fact that President Trump started a dialogue with us, with President Putin. We talked at other levels as well, at the level of Secretary of State and yours truly. And the presidential aide of the Russian president meets with the special envoy of President Trump. A lot of good words are said, namely that Russia and the U.S. have big prospects for promising high-tech energy and other projects. But in practice, nothing is happening. In practice, besides this regular dialogue, which is normal in people-to-people communication and state-to-state communication, everything else is the same line that was pursued by Biden. All sanctions adopted by Biden against Russia are still in force. On top of that, the Trump administration adopts its own initiatives to punish Russia in economic terms. You've mentioned Lukoil and Rosneft, and they do not hide their goal to get rid of Lukoil and Rosneft, to take them out of international business. Basically, the U.S. adopted a lot of postures that proclaim that the U.S. shall dominate on the global energy markets. Take Venezuela. Nobody even recalls that, actually. The operation carried out by the U.S. was aimed at destroying the drug business that was allegedly headed by President Maduro. Currently, everybody is openly saying that Venezuela is cooperating with the United States and that its national oil company is building its future activities in coordination with the United States. The Strait of Hormuz and the aggression against Iran was launched because, as President Trump put it, for 47 years, Iran has been terrorizing everyone. But until the 28th of February this year, the Strait of Hormuz was open to everyone, and the whole world enjoyed this route. It ensured, I believe, one-fifth of all energy supplies to global markets. And currently, the Americans demand that the Strait of Hormuz shall be open, but it was not shut down. Hence, we need to take a look at the root causes. Getting back to what Russia has been doing on international markets. Look, Lukoil and Rosneft are trying to be out of African markets. For instance, Lukoil and Rosneft had a lot of assets in the west of Africa, from the Balkans as well. When our companies were working, they had good business. If we take a look at other parts of the globe, I mentioned Venezuela, Venezuela has been working with Rosneft, and now the Americans want to take this cooperation, and hardly can we talk about cooperation on equal footing. Take a look how the Americans are planning to restore Nord Streams. I'm talking about two gas pipelines, and they were blown up. The Americans under Biden said that these gas pipelines would not work, but now they accuse the Ukrainians of blowing up these two pipelines. Actually, four pipelines. Three out of four were blown up. The Americans want to buy over the part that was owned by the European companies at a price that is 10 times smaller than the Europeans invested. And they would say that the Germans would say, okay, we will use this gas pipeline. But the prices will not be the result of arrangements between the supplier, Russia and Germany. But the prices will be dictated by the Americans that would purchase this pipeline from the Europeans. They openly stated that they wanted to seize transit gas pipeline from Russia to Europe out of Ukraine in order to control these flows as well. Therefore, their goal is to seize everything, to seize all energy routes that are important. This goal is pretty clear, and I am confident that India understands what is happening, and it's not a force majeure, an act of God that the Europeans recall when they strongly refused to have contracts on energy supplies from Russia. Now they try to ban our gas and oil simply because Russia needs to be punished. But you know that we do not punish anyone, and we treat our commitments in good faith. The commitments that we have in our relations with our partners, it doesn't matter whether we are talking about friendly or non-friendly countries. If we reached an agreement, it's in the Russian tradition to live up to arrangements. In the West, they have different traditions. They like to cancel history, to cancel agreements, to come up with some excuses to once again live at the expense of others, to punish, punish, and punish. Europe is a home of colonialism, and it has lost its ability. And now these abilities are shown by the United States. They put Europe into dire crisis energy-wise, food-wise. Probably Europe will be the one to be affected most from the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz, let alone the fact that the ban to buy Russian oil and gas means that they will need to switch to U.S. supplies of LNG, which comes at a higher price. Therefore, the European budgets will have another brunt in addition to the hundreds of billions of euros sent by Europe to Ukraine, so that Ukraine can continue this European aggression against our country. They so zealously defend that their cause is right, and they say that Ukraine will be victorious and Russia will have a strategic defeat, and they are so joyful of the funding in providing 90 billion euros. I am curious to know whether they provide the statistics to the European Parliament, namely how pricey it is for Europe to buy energy that they will get from other sources instead of cheap Russian oil and gas. I can assure you that India's interests when it comes to Russian supplies, they will not be affected, and we will do our utmost to ensure that this unfair play, unfair competition, could not affect our arrangements. It is also very important to take into account a broader picture. Nord Stream pipelines were blown up. Currently, we have this aggression in the Strait of Hormuz. And now they even say that the Bab el-Mandeb Strait could be the field of confrontation as well. And in this case, the damage done to global energy could not be estimated. And in this regard, in our relations with India and in a broader Eurasian context within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it is important for us to develop solutions that will ensure that we do not depend on the risks of such aggressive actions by Western countries, on the dismantlement of global economy and subduing the global economy to their own vested interests. When we were presiding over BRICS, this was 2 years ago, currently India is the BRICS chair, we came up with a number of initiatives that seek to develop independent infrastructure. I'm talking about a cross-border payment system and payment settlement infrastructure. BRICS Grain Exchange was proposed as well as the new investment platform, reinsurance entity. And currently, up until recently, all these tracks have been completely monopolized by Western institutions. But gradually, as we develop such infrastructure that is not prone to arbitrary behavior, as we have settlements in national currencies, not in dollars or euros, by doing so, we create safeguards and guarantees for future development. And the plans to develop India by 2027 should have such a safety net, because otherwise, all of a sudden, they do not like what Russia is currently doing, and today they do not like what China is doing. Who will they not like tomorrow? We could talk about any country, but primarily we are talking about countries of the Eurasian continent that includes, by the way, Persian Gulf countries. They carefully follow the way the Americans address their problems. What will happen when the anger of Washington will turn to somebody who we cannot imagine? This is something that is of concern to everyone. Definitely, we need to move forward, and I do hope that this topic establishing safe mechanisms and chains and settlement platforms will be one of the focal points at BRICS meetings in India. In September, there will be the BRICS summit. Probably this is one of the most topical issues today.
The Strait of Hormuz tensions, they are pushing several Asian countries, including Japan, to increase their Russian oil imports. How do you view this shift, Mr. Foreign Minister, especially given the earlier Western pressure on these countries to not buy Russian oil at all?
You know, I would not like to comment this at length. They put pressure on everything, demanding that they should not purchase Russian oil, and this is unfair play. These are colonial or neo-colonial methods. You can describe it in different ways. But we're talking about these methods to exploit others. You shouldn't purchase cheap Russian oil. You should purchase my expensive oil and buy expensive LNG from the U.S. We will rule the world by controlling global energy. Not everyone caves into such pressure. India has repeatedly stated that it will define on its own whom to buy energy from. Well, reportedly, Indians refused to accept one tanker carrying Russian oil. But all in all, India has made its position pretty clear. The Japanese touched upon this topic, but the foreign minister, well, the new foreign minister, Mr. Motegi, who used to be foreign minister beforehand, he said that we will continue to put pressure on Russia and we will stand with our Western colleagues as one. But we are having a hard time without the Russian oil. If they are ready to buy our oil, well, we have never turned economy and arrangements into politics.
Disruptions in and around the Strait of Hormuz, they've driven up global oil prices. Does this reflect a larger pattern where Western countries, they start a conflict and it's the global South that pays the price?
I believe that there is truth to that. But the most important point is that the United States wanted to take as much routes of energy supplies to the global energy markets. And this was exploited by the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. He once confessed that he waited for many decades when Washington realizes that it is necessary to attack Iran, to destroy, to dismantle it. But at the end of the day, certainly, the consumers are the ones to suffer. What was destroyed was the globalization principles that was proclaimed for many years by the West, led by the U.S., namely a dialogue between consumers and suppliers of energy. And this dialogue has been developing, including within G20. Incidentally, and in its efforts, OPEC Plus always took into account the interests of consumers. There was a permanent trust-based dialogue with them. And currently, this is all dismantled only for the fact that only one would be in charge of these markets. Well, at least the current administration of Donald Trump are speaking frankly about that, and all countries should draw their own conclusions. As for the way it would be perceived by the global economy, even now, it is said that if the conflict stops right now, till 2026, the market would barely bounce back. And if it continues for several weeks or, God forbid, months, then the horizon for the end of crisis even further away.
During the India-Pakistan conflict last year, when drones, missiles, jets, S-400 systems were in play, the world reacted, so did Russia. But if I may, many in India, they expected a stronger response or a stronger show of support from Russia, given the depth of this relationship. How did you, Mr. Foreign Minister, view the conflict?
We have always tried, even since Soviet times, we tried to help India and Pakistan to overcome their differences, which are unavoidable in a situation where the British Empire was dismantled and parts of the British Empire, such as India, Pakistan, Bangladesh later, started to take shape as independent states. When the Soviet Union was dismantled as well, we had a lot of issues with neighbors. They started to emerge later, at a later stage. And the fact that the West tried to dismantle the rest of the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation itself, the West tried to do everything in its power so that former Soviet Union republics would become hostile towards the Russian Federation. Well, we remember that very well. I cannot rule out that in your relations with your neighbors, there's quite a lot of impact by external factors, and they have an interest in you being busy making strife with each other instead of concentrating on the tasks that we have already spoken about today. By that, I mean developing Eurasian intercontinental integration. The West does not want that at all. The West wants to set their own rules in Eurasia. They are creating all kinds of quads and trios and so on. However, when the terrorist attack happened in April 2025, President Putin was one of the first leaders who condemned it in very harsh terms and expressed his sincere condolences to the Indian leader and Indian nation. We have great sympathy for everything happening in India. Unfortunately, quite often natural disasters happen in India, and such terrorist attacks. We feel fully for the Indian nation. We have always tried to help overcome the crisis and are trying to build dialogue. I spoke with Foreign Minister Jaishankar and Minister Dhar as well. We know about the position of our Indian friends, that all of that, just like in your relations with China, primarily it's a matter of bilateral relations. India does not have an interest in some kind of mediation or stewardship, and we have full respect for that position, and we believe that it is very reasonable. Speaking about what can be done additionally, if you could give an example, what would you mean by that? When terrorist attacks happen in any country of the world, in Russia, quite a lot of attacks happened, especially lately by the Ukrainian terrorists that organized provocations on the Russian territory, deliberately sending their drones and missiles on civilian areas with no military infrastructure whatsoever. We'll hear sincere condolences from our friends. If our friends believe that something more could be done, we cannot impose ourselves on them. We'll be prepared to look at all requests and desires coming from our friends.
The BRICS presidency, it rotates every year, and it's India's turn now. You're going to be in New Delhi very soon. What does Russia expect from BRICS under India's presidency this year?
BRICS is an association that was created on the basis of Russia, India, China, RIC Association, later joined by Brazil and South Africa. Now it's grown beyond the five countries into 10 countries. Each chairing country naturally adds its own national flavor. India has outlined its priorities for the presidency, and these are the goals that reflect primarily the Indian national interests, including the movement towards 2047. Second, they reflect the principle of consensus, which is crucial in BRICS. And third, it ensures the consistency. I'd like to remind you about Kazan Summit decisions to create reinsurance, payment and settlement, and exchange mechanisms that would not be dependent on the impunity and whims of our Western colleagues. India intends to continue this work. It will take some time. India has a very intense agenda in all three dimensions of BRICS work. Trade and economy and financial, politics and security, as well as cultural and humanitarian cooperation. All three areas have events planned, and I'm sure they will enrich our BRICS association.
Islamabad is mediating between Washington and Tehran, or at least trying to. While BRICS includes Iran, it includes UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the mediation is happening elsewhere entirely. Missed opportunity for BRICS, Mr. Foreign Minister.
The representative of a country chairing the BRICS Association, well, it's strange to hear it from you. If our Indian friends would have an interest in that, I think we would only welcome that. The proactive role of BRICS in trying to overcome, in facilitating and overcoming the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz. We are not as presidents, but participants of BRICS. We suggested that we elaborate a statement. However, because of great differences during the agreement of the talks between the UAE and Iran, this statement did not come to life. I think that now at the ministerial meeting in New Delhi, if the chair proposed to come back to the topic without emotions, but rather in essence focusing on the initial causes of what's happening, we would support such action. And I'd like to repeat myself once again. It's important to keep in mind, always to keep in mind, the primary causes. We see the West, the way the West disregards the primary root causes. We've seen that during the Ukrainian crisis. The West organized the coup d'etat in 2014, and that sabotage, the agreement reached the day before, which was guaranteed by the European Union. And that agreement was thrown away by organizing the coup d'etat. It was bloodshed. All citizens of Crimea and Donbass who did not agree with the coup d'etat were declared terrorists and the war was waged against them. Later, Crimea held a referendum in 2014. The West said immediately that it was an annexation of Crimea and that gave a start to the Ukrainian war. We started to explain that Crimea simply refused to live under the authority of those who used Western weapons with Western money to conduct a coup d'etat, but they don't want to listen to it. Just like now in the UN Security Council, when we're discussing the situation in the Strait of Hormuz, the US is saying that we need to condemn Iran, and we're saying, but Iran is responding to something. Let's outline the initial cause, that it was an unprovoked aggression against Iran. No. And they're trying to convince some Arab countries that this is the right logic, that these are two different wars. They say the war of the US and Israel against Iran is just because they're destroying the nuclear bomb. Though such bomb is not in existence, first and foremost. Second, in June 2025, President Trump already claimed that all nuclear materials of Iran had been destroyed. Now they're destroying them once again, that nuclear issue. And the other war is that Iran just woke up one morning and closed down the Strait of Hormuz. You know, in the Soviet Union, people would always whisper about how primitive Soviet propaganda was. But I believe that it was way ahead of what we're hearing right now from the Western ideologists who try to justify the atrocities happening right now. I believe that BRICS is quite a fitting association to launch such an initiative. So we'll see. You know, sometimes it seems the desire to move ahead smoothly dominates. And I'll share a secret with you without any details. But when preparing materials for the meetings of foreign ministers of BRICS, for example, usually all the global issues are listed, and the BRICS position is confirmed on the key crisis situations around the world. Recently, great resistance was met when discussing a regular proposal to confirm the position of BRICS countries towards the two-state solution of the Palestine and Israel conflict. It had never been initiated before. I believe that it means that all of the efforts that are being taken right now on Venezuela, on Iran, Cuba, Greenland, now Canada, it was also mentioned as one of the upcoming issues on the agenda. All of these issues are moving us away from settling the longest, the most negative crisis in the world, that is, crisis around Palestine. Now we are all talking about creation of the state of Palestine. However, Israel said that there will never be a state of Palestine. President Trump launched its own initiative about the Gaza Strip, but not to create a state of Palestine there. He did not even mention the West Bank, but he wants to create a recreational zone, a casino, and entertainment. The idea of justice is not mentioned in the rhetoric anymore, despite the fact that all relevant UN verdicts are still there. Now we are going back to primary root causes. They want to forget all about them. They want to change the agenda and to shift into the areas where it would allow to promote the Western concept of the development of the world in general, so that the whole world will remain dependent on Western concepts and Western energy, Western financial institutions. We never suggest to put any condemnations front and center in BRICS. However, BRICS is a positive alternative, and we need to cherish it, to foster it, and to strengthen it annually through positive spread of our experience, our vision, and our practical actions.
The last few months, Western commentators, they are constantly labeling the BRICS bloc as fractured and fragmented, all that because of a lack of consensus on Iran. But do you think, Foreign Minister, the absence of consensus or a joint statement signals failure?
No, I don't think so. In the modern world in general, words mean little. Actions matter. My American colleagues also prove that you should not follow the words, but rather track the real deeds. And we see the real deeds. If we see the BRICS role in the crisis around Hormuz as simply to issue a statement, well, it's not what we mean. We mean BRICS as a forum. While they represent two camps, so to speak, Iran and the United Arab Emirates, they both are very close strategic partners for us. For many years, they have promoted the concept of ensuring security and cooperation in the Gulf with participation of all Arab monarchies in the Gulf and with participation of Islamic Republic of Iran. I have no doubt that when these plans of unleashing aggression against Iran were being hatched, one of the goals was to prevent the normalization of relations between Iran and Arabs. In a wider context, I remember that many years ago, King Abdullah II of Jordan held a summit for reconciliation between Sunni and Shia, and now everything is being done to prevent this reconciliation so that Iran, one of the main Shia states, would be presented as a real outcast, while the rest, the neighbors of Iran in the Persian Gulf, would gather in associations that, first of all, would not be aimed at solving the issue of Palestine. At the price of normalizing relations with Israel, they would have to betray the cause of Palestine. I cannot say that we're following all of it very formally, and we demand that the UN decision on Palestine to be implemented only because it exists. I have no doubt that without the creation of the Palestine state, we'll keep a hotbed of extremism for many years to come, for decades. It will be a hotbed of tension that would bring suffering to everyone, to Israel, to its Arab neighbors, because Israel responds to extremism and terrorist actions disproportionately. It will be a perpetual mobile, a constant driver, an irritant that will foster the critical situation in its hot phase for many decades. I think many understand that. While Israel wanted to use the support of the U.S. and decided to completely disregard the Palestine decision and to make something else of Palestine and resettle Palestinians to Indonesia, Somalia, maybe they would offer India to take them in as well. We haven't been offered yet. We are going back to the time when everything is solved through force, when there is no international law recognized by anyone. President Trump also said that he doesn't care about international law. We don't want to become antagonistic with anyone in promoting normal, mutually respectful relations within BRICS in order to find a balance of interests. I think this is a very constructive alternative. It should not be viewed as an alternative, actually, just something that should be on our agenda.
India and China remain divided by border tensions. There was no face-to-face for some 5 long years until Kazan, hosted by President Putin. When you saw Mr. Modi and Mr. Xi shake hands in the very cold Kazan, how did you, Mr. Foreign Minister, feel personally? Because you would assume so much went behind the scenes. Did Moscow work some quiet magic there?
We have never tried to impose any arrangements or any meetings. We are happy that in Kazan, 2 leaders of the states that are our close friends and strategic partners met, and this was upon a mutual agreement. We were happy to provide the venue for this meeting, and I do hope that this conversation was useful. Well, at least this conversation was followed by broader negotiations that are still ongoing after the well-known conflict. And to a major extent, these agreements have already been met already. I talked with my counterparts, Foreign Minister Jaishankar and Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and they confirmed that there is progress and that negotiations are ongoing. I believe that there will be another BRICS summit where the 2 leaders could also meet, and if the host of the summit could have a chance to have a bilateral with other participants, including the President of China, I believe that everyone would appreciate that. Earlier, I've mentioned RIC, Russia, India, China, an entity that was initiated by my great predecessor, Foreign Minister and Prime Minister Primakov, as early as in 1998, I believe. And up until recently, well, there were some 20 ministerial meetings within this format. However, within the last 5 years, there were no bilaterals or trilaterals. There was COVID pandemic, then a border conflict between India and China. I believe that it would only be logical to resume such ministerial meetings between Russia, India, and China. I remember that we had a very constructive dialogue within this format. Besides bilateral dialogue between New Delhi and Beijing, meetings within broader formats, BRIC, RIC, SCO, helped build trust and helped build awareness that we belong to a great Eurasian continent.
And lastly, if I ask you to describe India-Russia in one word, what would that be, Foreign Minister? But also, what would the wider world lose if India and Russia drifted apart? And what would it gain if they stayed closely aligned?
There is no one word to describe these relations, and it's not because human languages are not eloquent enough. It's just hard to imagine so rich a relationship. As for a scenario when Russia and India drift apart, it is not possible to imagine that. It is not possible to do that. We started our conversation with the pillars of Russia-India relations, namely friendship. Hindi-Rusi, bye-bye, is not just some funny motto. It is part of our culture. Indian movies, Raj Kapoor, and recent movies and series are very popular in Russia, everywhere, in various parts of Russia. As for the economy, joint production of energy, nuclear energy, other types of energy, joint production of military goods, culture and people-to-people contacts, political summit-level dialogue, that is trust-based, and that is unparalleled, and it is not possible to destroy, to dismantle it. And most importantly, it's the feeling of peoples towards one another. Those who are worried about the future of friendship between Russia and India, I think they should not be. We should always see the threats that some try to put regarding our relations. They try to thwart our relationship. They try to create some entities that are closed. They try to impose their approaches to relations. And we see all that, as do our friends in India. And it makes it even more valuable that these attempts are futile.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, many thanks for your time.